You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105, a programme about books and writing with a local slant wherever we can. And today we've got a Cambridge trio of children's authors. Got interviews with Pippa Goodhart and Clementine Beauvais, and my studio guest today is Helen Moss. Helen, hello.
Hello, lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you as well. And I'm going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But I thought we might chat a little bit about Enid Blyton to begin with, because your books are often compared to Enid Blyton's books. Are you a fan?
Oh, yes, I am a fan, and I really was a fan as well when I was younger. They were the books that I remember just devouring, reading my way through. I loved The Famous Five, the adventure books, the Five Finders and Dog. I really did love them, and I am a big fan of her books. Yes.
Reading about her, I came across these two adverbs, or adjectives rather, that I'd never come across before, Blytonian and Blytonesque.
Yes.
She still casts quite a long shadow over writing to children's writing today, doesn't she?
She does. Well, she's still extremely popular. If you go into any bookshop or even, you know, the airport, W.H. Smith's, alongside current books, there will be, not as sort of some specialist vintage thing, but actually on a bestseller shelf all of its own, there will still be Enid Blyton books. So they have something that children still absolutely love reading.
What is it? What is that something, do you think?
I think it's a mixture of the sense of children being able to do things for themselves, that independence, that ability to just go and sort the world out yourself as a child, with very sort of marginalised, ineffectual adults kind of drifting around the edges. It's that, and I think it is also the escapism of the locations. They do tend to be wild Cornwall, or, you know, off on a sort of somewhere special. Though, having said that, the Five Finders and Dog are sort of fairly just suburban settings, quite ordinary settings, although to today's children they're quite exotic, because even in my childhood I remember being kind of bamboozled by cooks and maids and all of these kind of things. But that kind of adds to the charm in a way.
My children still love reading them. I must say, as a modern reader, I wince a little bit at some of the phrases she uses and the way she depicts, well, working class characters or ethnic minorities. I suppose you're reading it through a modern sensibility.
That's
and
right.
She was writing, when was she writing?
I think 40s onwards. I mean, really over quite a long period. It's true. There's quite a lot in them that does make you feel uncomfortable, and things that you know that, you know, you pretty much know who the baddies are going to be in a way. And that's, you know, that's not good. And in a way, that's something that I've tried to do in my books, is to try and keep what we love about Enid Blyton and recast it in with, as you say, a more modern sensibility. And with the children being a little bit different, I think the children were just the tone, the character. Again, to us now, they seem slightly exotic, unusual characters, whereas I've tried to, you know, recast it with hopefully kids that the children reading will actually recognise as more like themselves.
Oh, well, we're going to talk in more detail about your work, but we're going to play a track of yours first, one of your favourite tracks. This is Corinne Bailey-Ray and Put Your Records On. Why did you choose this one?
Oh, I chose this one because I just think this is a lovely feel-good song, and it's a real mix of particularly girls, but everybody, have a good time and go for your goals, but also don't forget to enjoy yourself along the way. I think as a writer sometimes we sit very hunched up over our desks all by ourselves, and I think this just has a really great message of a sort of celebration.
That That was Corinne Bailey-Ray and Put Your Ruckus On. I don't think I introduced myself, actually. I'm Lee Chambers. I'm presenting a Bookmark. Normally, I present it with Alex Rouget. This is the first show I'm doing it solo. It's all gone to pieces already. But my studio guest is Helen Moss. And Helen is the author of both the Adventure Island and Secrets of the Tomb series. Last year, The Phoenix Code was named by Heffers as one of its children's paperbacks of 2014 and was also longlisted for the Oxfordshire Book Awards, the primary school category. So, Helen, how many books in total have you written?
Oh, that's a good question. There's 14 in the Adventure Island series. There are three, well, there will be three in the Secrets of the Tomb series. One came out last year. One I've actually written, but it doesn't come out until next year. And then I'm about to start the next one. I've also written a series of four books under a pseudonym, Isabella Cass, and those were called Superstar High, a very different series, very much about girls going to stage school. Great fun, but very different. And there is actually one other book in a drawer of my desk, which was the first book I wrote, which is a mystery, science-based detective mystery set in Cambridge, which is still waiting for somebody to snap it up.
Oh, that sounds great.
It was my practice book.
So a silly question, but what makes a series? Is it having the same characters?
I think a series, you do have to have the same characters. Some series will be one story essentially continuing over the books. Others will be discrete, sort of like in a mystery series, a discrete mystery that will get solved by the end of the book, and then you have another one. The Adventure Island series is very much like that. It's the same characters. They solve a mystery in each book, although there are themes and subplots that sort of develop in the background throughout them. There's absolutely no need to read them in order. Whereas The Secrets of the Tombs, actually, again, you can read each one and the mystery in that book will be solved, but the mysteries are very much linked. There will be a reveal, as it were, in the third and final book that will pull everything together. So I think some series are more tightly linked and, you know, hang together as one story, whereas others will be very much kind of little building blocks that you can just keep slotting them in.
And yours build on, so the character's story develops as the series develops.
Yes, again, I think there's a quite a wide range between different series as to whether the characters essentially say the same. And you have to make some quite tricky decisions, actually, as an author, which you don't really think about when you start, necessarily. You know, are they going to get older? How are you going to deal with time? You know, time is a bit of a problem. You know, do you fit things in realistically into particular holidays or particular times? Or do you just simply sort of make them exist outside of time and things just happen? And they can just, you know, each one be individual. In Adventure Island, I have made it so that with a slight stretch of imagination, the mysteries do fit in to the holidays and you can sort of follow the time course and the children do get slightly older and their characters do develop. I do try to make it so that they actually change as a result of becoming friends and the things that they do. But again, they don't change so much that if you started with book 14, you wouldn't recognise them in book one.
And as a writer, I suppose it gives you the chance to get to know characters very well.
It's lovely. I absolutely love it. Particularly the children in Adventure Island, who I have brought up in a parallel to my own kids, are really real to me to the extent that I have been told by my children sometimes, particularly when I'm in a writing mode, they'll pull me up because I'll say things to them that they say, actually, that's Scott, you know, one of the characters in the book. I mixed up, for example, my son's football team that he follows with Scott's football team.
Blending fact and fiction.
I know. He said, I don't support Chelsea, that's Scott. I do remember another thing they used to say to me was, you'd let Emily, Jack and Scott do that when they were trying to do something dangerous that I wouldn't let them do. I said, yeah, they're my fictional children. They don't have to wear cycle helmets. Or, you know, they do have to tell their parents. I was quite careful with that, actually, that I didn't let them do anything that was obviously irresponsibly dangerous unless they absolutely had to. There was a little bit of you know, trying not to be completely irresponsible.
And when does the series come to an end? Does it come to an end when you feel it happening naturally?
Well, in reality, I think it's probably when the publishers tell you it's come to an end. In, you know, practical terms, that's quite often the case, that they'll just say, you know, we think that series has lived its life. That's the case with Adventure Island. I hope in the future, and possibly, might do some more. You know, it wasn't that we decided that we didn't like it anymore. It was simply that 14 is quite a lot of books. And I think the idea is to sort of let them settle a bit. And also we'd have to deal with the question of, okay, they are now, they started the books at 12 and 13. By the end of book 14, they've managed to pack 14 mysteries into about a year and a half, which is pretty good going. So they're now 13, 14. And if they get any older, it's not really realistic for those characters anymore. I'd have to think about, you know, whether we'd have a parallel series or something like that. The Secrets of the Tombs one was always set out to be, it was going to be three books. In a sense, you could almost say, well, it's a trilogy, except I think a trilogy always really implies that the story, you do have to sort of read. You couldn't just stop at the end of book one and have a complete story. You have to read the next two. Whereas a series of three, as opposed to a trilogy, you know, each one does stand alone, even though it's linked.
And there's still an appetite for series. I mean, I suppose the most famous is Harry Potter, of course. Did that sort of rejuvenate the interest in series?
I think children love series. I mean, they love series. Harry Potter's sort of at one end of the spectrum because it's, as we were saying, you know, that the story does go through very much from book. You couldn't really read those out of order. It goes through, follows the children. They do grow older. There is a whole story that goes over this, you know, the sequence, and is resolved right at the end. At the other end of the extreme, you've got something like Beast Quest or Rainbow Magic, where it is a series, but each one, you know, you can keep adding to them. They don't necessarily, the children don't necessarily get older, and you can add and add and add. Children love both, I think. They and they love the things that sometimes parents don't like about, say, Rainbow Magic or those kind of big series, in that they're quite predictable, they're quite similar, they're quite samey. Children, particularly at a certain, you know, stage of their reading, they absolutely love the fact that they're quite predictable and quite samey. That's what they really like. It's just a variation on a theme. You don't want Rainbow Magic to suddenly become something completely different. You want it to be what you love, just more. So I think, and children are so loyal to series, I've found. They absolutely get into the world. They love the characters. They love the fact. I think, you know, we all have a bit of a kind of a nerdy geek tendency, and children particularly really do, because they love to say, oh yes, in book two, you know, you had something happened in this location and it was really exciting because somebody said that, and then in book 10 they went back and they found out something else. That's the great thing about a series. You can really bring the children into the world because they become the experts on their own series.
Helen, you wrote your first book in 2007. Prior to that, you were studying for a PhD in psycholinguistics at Cambridge. Is there a link at all?
There is a bit of a link. There's also in a bit of a time gap as well, because I finished my PhD and worked as a lecturer and a researcher for about 15 years in between those two things, because I'm, you know, quite old. So, but there really is a link, because psycholinguistics is obviously all about language, about how we understand language, the meaning of language, and memory for language, which is really what my passion was that led me to do that. And writing obviously is all about words too. It's really just a different way of working with language. And sorry.
No, it's fine, because I mean, your novels are refreshingly innocent, I think, and that is what people respond to. And some of that is about the language, you know, and about the way the characters are presented in very straightforward means. I mean, that was obviously your philosophy when you wrote the books.
Yes, I did think, I thought quite a lot about the way that the books are written. I mean, I suppose there's two aspects. In one way, you simply write the story in the best way that you can. You have an idea of the characters and they simply speak as they speak, and you tell the story in the clearest way. But at the same time, I was also aware of trying to have a certain tone to the books, a very, I hope, contemporary, but not too caught in the moment, because things get old very quickly if you try and be too slangy. But I tried to get a balance. I know I didn't always get it right, because sometimes people have told me, oh, you know, people don't say that anymore. But that side of it. But also trying to use vocabulary in quite a precise way, so that it wasn't too complicated, but that I wasn't restricting the vocabulary. If there was a particular word that I thought would describe an atmosphere or an action, I used that word, even if I knew that it was probably a word that would be outside the younger reader's vocabulary. I simply made sure that I used it a few times in different contexts, or reinforced it, or occasionally got Jack, who's the younger brother, to make a mistake, for example, or to ask what something meant, so that the younger readers could pick up words in that way. Because I think reading is so important for vocabulary, for learning vocabulary. I mean, I'm not saying anything new, this is obvious, but if you try and restrict the words to the words that children already know, they're never going to actually learn any new words. And children are absolutely brilliant at learning new words, even words that people think, oh, that, you know, a little bit long, a little bit complicated. Any 7-year-old will tell you in minute detail the difference between a Tyrannosaurus Rex, a Brontosaurus and a Diplodocus, and pronounce them all beautifully. And if you tell them 5 more dinosaur names, they'll know them by tea time. So, you know, the same goes, I think, if you tell them the right word, you know, for making something worse is to exacerbate it. There's no reason why they won't be using that word by tea time.
They enjoy it, don't they?
They do, like actually, they do enjoy it. And so that's part of it. I try to weave that in, you know, not obviously every, you know, line. It's not, you know, let's learn some new vocabulary. But I have tried to just sort of make sure that that sort of reinforcement of some, and, you know, bringing things back in again, repeating use of words that I think are just maybe on the edge of the vocabulary to just to bring them in.
Well, we're going to try another technical thing now. Let's see how this goes. We're going to play your second track, which is Aretha Franklin, I Say a Little Prayer. Why did you choose this one?
I chose this, it's really indulgent, because this is my favourite song of all time, so I love to hear it. I think it is something that it's... I love songs that tell stories, and one of the best types of story is a story that is universal but also hinges on a tiny detail. And this image of a woman in the morning putting on her makeup, so you've got that lovely detail, but at the same time just saying a prayer, just thinking about and loving the people that she loves in her life. I actually get a little lump in my throat as I think of it, because it is that universal and detail that I think is the heart of a good story and song.
And that was Aretha Franklin, I Say a Little Prayer, and you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105. We had some technical issues earlier. We tried to play an interview with Pippa Goodhart. It didn't quite work. We think we've sorted them out now. So let's hear from Pippa Goodhart again. I met her in Grantchester. Pippa, let's just remind you, the author of more than 90 books for children, including some in the Winnie the Witch series and the award-winning You Choose. I met her at her home in Grantchester and asked her how she came to be a children's author.
Sort of by mistake. I wasn't the sort of child who was always going to be a writer. I wasn't a very good reader. But I got a Saturday job in Heffer's Bookshop in Cambridge and kept going at that through holidays, even when I was at university. And then after that, I went back full time and they put me in the children's shop. So I had 5 years of children's book selling and got hooked on children's books. And when I moved away, it was suggested to me by my husband that I should have a go at writing a story for a competition, and that became the first book.
So that was why it was children and young people, not adults?
I suppose it was, but I do think that children are the best audience. They're the most honest and interesting and fun, as are the books. You can play with picture book format and so on that, of course, you don't get with adults.
And your list of books, I mean, it's immense. It's from Winnie the Witch to You Choose and Just Imagine to books for older children about the Canadian Gold Rush. How do you keep track of all those different ideas? Are you writing more than one book at the same time?
Yes, sort of, in that books take a long time, not just to write, but to come out. So once you've written a draft and sent it off, there's a long pause before it comes back from the publisher for more working. So there are usually several books being juggled. And picture books are something you can play with in odd moments.
And where does the impetus for each book come from? Does it come from you or your publisher? Do you think I'm going to write a book about the Canadian Gold Rush? Or
I did with that one. It varies. The Canadian Gold Rush one was something that was set going by a family ring that was said to have been brought back from the Klondike Gold Rush. And I got interested and read around and wanted to write about it. But those sort of books, and most of the picture books, are me having an idea and wanting to go at it. I never know whether they're going to be published. So those are done in my own time, as it were. But when publishers come and ask me for things, everything else gets put aside, and those are the proper work jobs.
And can you choose what illustrator you work with?
Again, sometimes, sometimes not. Sometimes you don't have any dealings with illustrators until you see the finished book. Sometimes, as with Nick Sharratt with You Choose, I get to work with him quite closely. And of course, Winnie the Witch already was the creation of Corky Paul. So I had his sort of illustrations in mind from the start.
Well, you choose. I wanted to talk to you about, because that has been the favourite book of both of my daughters.
Good.
We've spent many a bedtime going through page by page. So it has very happy memories for me. Do you get lots of people coming up to you and saying, you know, you've created this moment between me and my child?
Yes, I do. It's the most satisfying book of all, partly because of that. And it's the one that is brought to me tatty and falling apart with use, which is the greatest compliment. And it's used with a huge range of abilities and ages and different occasions. And I hear so many stories about it. But it was one I had to really fight to get published. It was turned down by 9 publishers, all for the same reason. It doesn't tell a story. And of course, it doesn't tell a story. What it is a catalogue of many, many, many ideas. And the stories happen in the children's heads.
I was going to say, it fires their imagination. That's important to you as a writer, presumably, how much information you give them. You don't want to give them too much.
Exactly. There's a great power in the space that you leave between words and pictures and a complete story, and that space is then filled by the child's imagination. And often the best stories are the result of blanks, which sounds lazy.
What about language? Because I guess you have to choose your words carefully, particularly for younger children.
Up to a point. I mean, you're aware of the age that you're writing for, and occasionally with early reading books you might be given a list of words to use, especially now with the phonics thing. That is odd. You are given a very strict list of words, and that's quite restricting. But on the whole, I think you just naturally use appropriate language without having to think about that too much.
And when you're writing for, sometimes you'll be writing for younger children, sometimes older children, does that access different parts of you and your brain and your personality?
I'm sure it does, and I love playing around, jumping around from different ages. Obviously a historical adventure story with no pictures, you've got the words painting all the pictures, and the words have to do an awful lot more. And then when it's picture books, I don't illustrate, but I think pictures a lot. So, yes, it is. It's a different sort of storytelling game that's going on.
Do you have a favourite age group that you like to write for?
I haven't written for teenagers, and I think that's because I was such a boring teenager myself. I was a sulker rather than a rebel. But the whole proper childhood age I love. I've just become patron of Home Start in Cambridgeshire, and 2 days ago did a storytelling session with some 3-year-olds. And they were delightful.
That must be wonderful to actually see your books having an impact on
your
listeners.
Yes, and of course it's very real, the reactions you get at those ages, and to set them all giggling, and it's just wonderful.
And you've said that your books serve up some familiar part of life and make the reader see it anew. What do you mean by that?
I suppose that's what all stories are doing, giving life experiences, whether they're fantastical or real. The emotions are real in any of those. And you're giving different points of view. So if you read a book, you experience being bullied and being a bully. All those different, same situation, but coming at it from different ways. And I think it opens children's minds and makes them more thinking people.
And tell me about snorting.
that's a particular thing that I grew up with in my family. I don't think anyone else uses that word. Snorting is very important. It's the skill of criticising, but in a positive way. It sounds like sneering, but it isn't. I have various snorters. Chief snorter is my husband, and it has been children. My daughters paid on occasion to do it. They aren't handily around anymore for that. But I have friends who we snort each other's work, and that's very useful.
And that's vital, I would imagine.
It is, because you can't see the wood for the trees. You need fresh, honest views. I think it's that honesty is integral to snorting.
And you grew up in Cambridge and you live near Cambridge.
I grew up in Grantchester, went to the village school and grew up here and peddled to my Saturday job in Heffers. And then when I married, I moved to Leicester for 26 years. And then 2 years ago, we came back to Grantchester. Built our own house, and something we had planned for a long time.
So you're obviously very fond of this area.
Lovely to be back, yes. We still have family around, and of course the place is wonderful.
And what was your favourite book as a child?
I know exactly what that was. I, as I said, was not a good reader, didn't enjoy it when I was told to read a book, but books that made me into readers were the Laura Ingalls Wilder Little House books. I think my mother read me the first one, and then I wanted to know more.
What was it about those that appealed?
It was partly the beautiful illustrations, I think, so you could see as well as read about the life of a pioneer family in the west of America, but also the fact that it was real. I found that really exciting, and you know, the practical details of how to make a house and that sort of thing.
And you've got over 40 books to your name.
Got over 90 books to my name.
Over 90 books to your name, wow. And are you still enthusiastic?
Oh, yes. Who wouldn't be? There are so many stories to tell in different ways. No, it's a nice job to have.
That was Pippa Goodhart there. I've got Helen Moss in the studio with me. Pippa was talking there about snurting and the feedback that she gets from other authors on her work. Who snurts for you?
Actually, I don't get snurted very much by many people, except it's my editor. I've been really lucky. All of the books that I've written so far, I've had the same editor, who is absolutely wonderful. And she helps bounce ideas for the plot around and find all the loopholes in the plot before I start. Because obviously with a mystery, the plot is really important. And then she'll give me very detailed feedback. But nobody else reads the book in draft except my editor.
Your children don't snort for you then? You don't use them as readers?
Not as readers. No, I will do a lot of sounding out ideas with my children. When I say children, they're teenagers now. I've decided that you can't actually refer to them as my children very easily once they're taller than you. And both of mine are much taller than me. But when I
started out...
That's
a problem for me, because I'm 5 foot, so they were taller than me very quickly.
It happens, especially with boys, it happens quite early on. But around the dinner table, there will be a lot of, you know, plot development going on, and it's often, of course, because they're mysteries and there's lots of crime involved, it's usually things like, you know, do you think you could poison somebody without anybody else knowing, or how would you, you know, hack into a computer, or these kind of things, and I'll try out little bits and pieces, but the actual draft, I find it easier just to work with my editor rather than with lots of other people. I do belong to a writing group, and I do sometimes read out little pieces that I'd like to get some feedback from, and that is very useful, but it's not a sort of a routine regular kind of critique group or anything.
And Pippa was saying that how appreciative an audience children are. Do you find that? And you have quite a lot of interaction with children on your website, don't you?
Yes. Oh, our children are just the best readers ever, because if they like a book, they love it, and they don't mince words. If they don't like it, they don't like it. If they love it, they love it. And I do, on the website, have lots of stuff, interaction with children, and also going out to schools, doing author visits, talking about the books and doing workshops. And children often email me just to tell me. I had an email just the other day just saying, what's your favourite animals? Mine are meerkats, snow leopards, tigers and dogs.
Oh, good choice. Yeah.
Love from. I said, yeah, good choice, actually. That's probably my top ones as well, along with sun pandas and sea otters. So, but those kind of things. I just love it that to be now as an author, much more than in the past, you can be so accessible to the children through those kind of things.
And it's also children, they will tell you what they think, won't they? They love a puzzle, and presumably they tell you if they think you've got it right and they think you've got it, or if they think
yes,
you've got it wrong.
Yes, that's right. They'll tell you if they guessed who the person was who did it, or if it was too hard. That is actually quite a tricky one in a crime novel, because you have got to get the right level of difficulty so that it's not blaringly obvious who did it from the start, but it's not so complicated that the reader gets to, I mean, this is even for an adult as a reader, that you get to the end and you just think, well, hang on, that just doesn't, you know, make sense, or okay, it was them, but there was no reason, I could never have guessed that. It's that thing of just making the reader about half a step in front or behind the investigator the whole way through, so that you have those lovely moments of, oh, I know, and then you're right, and those other ones of just thinking, wow, okay, I didn't see that one coming. And you know, that's the challenge, and that's the joy really of writing a mystery novel. That's what makes it really special, I think, to actually do. But yes, children do tell you if you get it wrong.
Well, you're going to read an extract for us now. What's this from?
Well, I chose just a little bit from the very start, the opening section of the last book in the Adventure Island series, The Mystery of the Phantom Lights. just because it gives you a little sort of funny bit about the characters. And just to give a bit of background, this book opens from Jack's point of view. So there are two brothers, Jack and Scott, and Jack is the younger one, he's 12. And they both live in London usually, but they have, the setup is that they go and spend their holidays in on this little island off the coast of Cornwall called Castle Quay, which I made up because their dad's gone off somewhere. And they meet, they're not particularly impressed with this place, it's a bit in the middle of nowhere, but they meet a girl called Emily Wilde, who is obsessed with solving mysteries, and her dog. And they solve mysteries together, and over the course of the books, they become great friends. In this book, we start out, they have, over previous books, sort of been railroaded, really, into joining the nature group on Castle Quay. Jack is not really a big fan of nature, as he says. He quite likes it, but it doesn't like him. It's always biting him or something. But he does like camping. So here we go. We're starting out. Camping out on the moors was awesome, Jack Carter thought. Until, that was, you woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning with an urgent need to go to the bathroom. The moors were distinctly lacking in the bathroom department, which is why Jack was now stumbling around in the dark, searching for a conveniently placed gorse bush. A boy needed his privacy. Mission accomplished, Jack stepped out from behind the bush and started back towards the tents, which were pitched on a flat patch of grass and heather halfway down a rocky slope. He picked his way over the rough ground. He shivered and sped up. His sleeping bag was calling to him. That's when he slipped on a loose stone and fell flat on his face. And that's when he realised he couldn't see the tents. He must have strayed farther from camp than he'd thought. In fact, he wasn't even sure if he was heading in the right direction. He sat up, trying to get his bearings. It was so dark that he could hardly make out the outline of the craggy ridge that rose up from the other side of the valley. It was just a smudge of blacker blackness against a black sky. He looked back the way he'd come and saw the outline of the tents in the distance, lit by the faint amber glow of nightlight through the canvas. He stood up and hurried towards them. Now that he was on the right track again, he started hatching a plan. Obviously, he was going to have to creep around outside the tent he was sharing with Scott and make some spooky noises. It would be a crime to miss this golden opportunity to give his brother a fright. Should he go for a ghostly wail, he wondered, or a snarling werewolf effect? The key thing was to make sure he got the right tent. He'd learnt that lesson the hard way on the school camping trip to Hatfield Forest, when he'd accidentally performed his entire mutant zombie scarecrow routine for his elderly geography teacher, Miss Bodley, instead of his mates, Josh and Ali. But there was no danger of getting muddled this time. Jack and Scott's tent was a little apart from the rest of the group, next to the one that housed their friend Emily Wilde and her faithful dog Drift. And Emily's tent was hard to miss. It was more of a shelter than a tent, consisting only of sticks, leaves and a canvas sheet. And there was a rainwater catcher and a handcrafted washstand outside it. Emily liked to practice her survival skills whenever possible, in case she was suddenly called up by the security forces and sent off on a top-secret undercover mission in the wilderness. Scott and Jack had tried pointing out that, as she was only 13 years old, this was unlikely to happen any time soon. But, as was so often the case, Emily didn't listen. Jack had just made up his mind to treat Scott to a bone-chilling werewolf howl when he heard a noise behind him. A strange, snuffling, shuffling noise. He stopped in his tracks. Maybe it was Scott or Emily trying to scare him, or Drift out for a walk. But it couldn't be. Jack had kept his eyes fixed on the tent all the way back. He'd have noticed. There it was again. The noise was closer now. It sounded like the grinding of enormous teeth. Jack's heart began to pound, as if trying to break out of his ribcage with a sledgehammer. Was it a beast? All these wild moor-type places had beasts prowling around them. A Bigfoot or a Yeti or a giant black panther with massive fangs like a saber-toothed tiger, ready to tear him limb from limb. He wanted to make a run for the tents, but his legs seemed to think they were trapped in quicksand and were refusing to work. Jack closed his eyes and wished he was somewhere else, somewhere safe, somewhere with lights and shops and houses, somewhere like London. The beast was so close Jack could smell its meaty breath. It was no good. He had to see what was about to eat him. Slowly, very slowly, he turned round. His trembling torch beam picked out a pair of long, curved horns. Jack gulped. It wasn't just a beast. It was a demon beast. But then he saw soft white ears, big brown eyes, long black and white face with a slightly dopey expression. Jack laughed out loud. He'd noticed the herd of goats earlier in the evening. They belonged to Rosshendra Farm and were let loose on the high moors to graze. "Phew, give me some warning next time you creep up on me, mate," Jack said. "I was that close to having to overpower you with my grip of death." The joke that the goat blinked and worked its jaws from side to side. Jack patted the goat's neck and was turning to leave when he noticed three bright lights in the sky. White and red and green, they zoomed so low that they barely skimmed the ridge across the valley. They circled round and round, then hovered in one spot, shimmering and flashing, lighting up the shreds of cloud with shades of blood red and ghostly green. Below them, another light flickered on and off. Jack stared at the lights. What were they? Too bright and colourful for planets or stars, and you'd have to have a death wish to fly a plane that low over the ridge. They were hovering too long to be fireworks. Could it be a helicopter? Surely he'd have heard the whir of the rotors. Suddenly, Jack knew what he was looking at. A UFO, an unidentified flying object visiting Earth from a far-off planet. It was the only logical explanation. Just wait until Scott and Emily heard about this. The lights seemed to be coming closer. Uh-oh, Jack thought. He'd seen a programme on TV about alien abductions. Aliens beamed people up into their spaceships and experimented on them. Jack didn't want to be an experiment. I don't know about you, he whispered to the goat, but I'm out of here. But when he turned round, the goat had vanished.
Oh. It strikes me, listening to that, about the pace of something like that aimed at that readership. It has to be quite perky all the time, doesn't it?
Yes, I think so, yes. I think there has to be quite a lot of direct thought from the character. You have to be really with the character. Humour obviously helps. I mean, Jack is the sort of the funny character in the book, I suppose. He's always the one. He's got this, you know, imagination that takes him off into sort of different things. But yes, that I think that's true. You can't sort of have the pace too slow for very long. You can sort of slow it down, I think, once you get going a little bit. You can have like little slower, quieter bits in between all the action. Because if it's all action, it's, you know, to one level. But yes.
And I love Emily. She's such a brilliant character, as indeed are all the female characters in your books. They're very feisty, often kind of feistier than the boys.
Yes.
That was obviously a deliberate choice.
It was a deliberate choice to have Emily be, certainly to be feisty and independent. I mean, it wasn't really so much that she was a tomboy in the sort of sense of George in The Famous Five. She didn't want to be like a boy. I think she's just her own person. She's an only child. She is not that used to being around other kids. At first, in fact, she's quite prickly with Jack and Scott when they first meet because she thinks they're slightly idiotic. In fact, it's just because they're from London and they're not used to sort of a lot of things about the countryside that she just takes for granted. But yes, she's obsessed with smugglers, spies, solving mysteries. She always carries her investigation kit. She's very determined and slightly kind of dismissive of anybody who doesn't believe her about, you know, the smugglers and spies. Luckily on Castle Quay, she's usually right because there usually is a crime to be solved.
Ah, well, great. Well, talking about strong female characters, Clementine Beauvais is a researcher in education at Cambridge and an author of children's books. Her first series is set in Cambridge and features superheroine Sesame Seed, and she also writes the Royal Babysitter stories. I asked her what made her want to be a children's author.
I started writing when I was a child, and at the time, perhaps by default, I was a children's writer. And it, for the moment, I haven't yet perhaps been interested in writing for adults, so I guess I just continued writing books that are generally seen as and marketed as for children. It's not really a conscious decision, it's more the type of literature I like writing.
Yes, you describe yourself as a student of children's literature. What do you mean by that?
I'm not a student anymore, but I guess I still am in the sense that I'm still reading a lot of children's literature all the time. I did a master's in children's literature criticism and theory, and then I did a PhD in it. So in the very technical sense of the word, I was a student of it, very much reading contemporary children's literature, analysing it, writing about it, and I still do now.
What is it about children's literature that fascinates you?
it's the child and the adult-child relationship. I'm really fascinated by the way in which we construct fictions around children and around the concept of childhood and what that says about us as a society. So why children seem to crystallize so much passion and so much interest, even from people who don't have children and don't particularly care about real children. There's something about the concept of childhood that is so strong, and it appears very powerfully in children's literature.
And you've lived in France and then moved to the UK. Do you see any difference in the children's literature in the two countries?
Yes, there are quite a lot of differences. I also write in French, so I have a really direct experience of the difference in the publishing systems between the two countries. And it's really quite striking. To start with, the French are much less, perhaps less squeamish about the contents of the children's books. So it's kind of a well-known thing, but it's true that children's literature in France are generally scarier. They have stronger political content, especially for younger readers. They tackle very taboo subjects. This is partly because in France there's a lot of independent small publishing houses, which allow for that kind of thing to work. In the UK, the market is very dominated by a number of big publishing houses. So what that means is that the themes have to really appeal to a very wide audience, and as a result they might be less inclined to delve deep into themes that can be seen as difficult or controversial or violent. Apart from that, of course, Britain has a huge tradition of children's literature, so it's well regarded here, much better in fact than in France. So the status of the author and the illustrator is better in the UK. You're better paid to start, you know, with a kind of simple aspect of it. The industry is very well oiled in a way that doesn't quite happen in France, where it's still quite dismissed as a kind of subgenre of literature.
And your own books, your Sesame Seed books in particular, they're set in Cambridge. Yeah. Why did you set them in Cambridge?
It basically sprung to my mind like that. I was walking around Cambridge very often because at the time I didn't cycle. I'm still terrified of cycling, so I walked a lot. I had to walk to work every day for an hour through Cambridge. Every time, you know, you walk through Cambridge and you look up and you see all these little balconies and staircases and windows and gargoyles, and you think how much fun it would be to climb up there and look into all the secret passages. And these are things that you can't do if you're, you know, a student or a fellow of a college, but you could if you lived in a college and were a child. And that's how it started, really. I'd always wanted to have a kind of superheroine but without superpowers, so a little girl who would be sleuth and solving mysteries and being really active and imaginative, but very much in a realistic setting. And it kind of crystallized into the Sesame Seed stories.
And your girl characters, you mentioned there, the girl characters in all your books are very strong.
Yeah, and again, that's not a conscious decision that I've made, I think, to only have girl characters. It sort of happened like that. I think there's only one book that I've written out of the 13 that I've written so far that has a main male character. That's partly what comes to my mind when I'm writing the stories, and partly because, I mean, I do have quite strong feminist convictions, and I do think that children's books have to present strong heroines, and, you know, that's definitely part of the idea. But I guess another is that I probably remember as well the experiences of a little girl of 5, 8, 11, and then in my YA books, 16.
There's a lack of strong girl characters, I think, for younger readers. Would you agree?
For younger readers, it's interesting because, I mean, actually there are very strong characters, like Pippi Longstocking to start with, very old now, but incredibly strong girl figure. There's a number of books that I actually haven't read, but apparently are classics here and in the US, like Harriet the Spy. At the moment, there's a series actually called the Clementine series, confusingly, another one called Marty Maguire, and so there are some very strong girls. My problem is, and it's a lot of people's concern, is that these series about girls don't land on boys' laps because their parents think, and also, you know, the whole librarians, teachers, etc., that the boys will not identify with a girl heroine. So I do think that little girls are deeply enjoying those stories, but unfortunately little boys do not have access to them as much.
How do you get into the head of your readers, given the age group that you're writing for?
With more or less difficulty, depending on the book. So with the Sesame Seed series, it was very natural. I kind of joked that they felt so easy to write that it's probably that I have a mental age of 8 to 11-year-old. That's probably it, because it really felt very easy to write. With the Royal Babysitter series, which is aimed at slightly younger readers, it was much more difficult, actually. There was a lot of editorial work on the series to make them adhere to a number of conventions for writing for that age. Particularly in terms of humor, it gets much more difficult for that age because you have to be very aware of what kind of jokes will simply not work. And generally speaking, that's what happens really. It's not just your work, but also the editor's influence in telling you, we need to tone this down, we need to speed this up. Actually here, the readers could cope with more information. So it's always negotiated.
And with an illustrator as well, presumably, how does that relationship work?
So a lot of people tend to think that the illustrator and author collaboration is very intense, but in fact, it's not quite often. So what generally happens is that you send your text to a publisher. The publisher has an illustrator in mind when they read the text, and they will probably ask you if you like that illustrator. But the decision is not entirely in your hands. And then communication with the illustrator can be quite intense, or it doesn't have to be. You can have no communication whatsoever. You will give indications in your text of what you'd like the illustrations to be like. But sometimes they really, really improvise on your words, and I think that's actually really quite wonderful. So in the case of the Royal Babysitters, there are quite strict instructions that I had to give for the illustrations because the illustrations are part of the story. In the case of the Sesame Seed books, it was pretty much the illustrator's decisions as to what she would illustrate or not. So the degree of control really varies.
And I'm meeting you here at Homerton College where you work. Is there any crossover between your academic work and your life as a children's author?
There is increasingly, but I try to not emphasize the academic aspect when I'm in my author role and vice versa, because they are quite close. I mean, I am a fellow at Homerton College, and I research at the moment pretty much the sociology of childhood, and then I work on children's books. But these are still very distinct activities in my life, so I tend not to work on my children's books at all during the day, because that's my time for working on my research and my teaching. I think universities are increasingly happy with their fellows and, well, professors and lecturers doing activities that have nothing to do with their principal work as researchers, in part because it engages the public. My college has been very tolerant of that, but I still try not to emphasize it too much one way or another.
And what are you writing at the moment?
At the moment, I am writing the sequels to The Royal Babysitters. The second book is finished. It's called The Royal Wedding Crashers. It will be out in April. And I'm writing book 3 at the moment, as well as French books, because I also write a lot in French. And so at the moment, I'm working on a YA novel in French, which is due to come out next year. Always, you know, trying to think up new projects. And the great advantage once you're inside a publishing house is that you can really discuss these projects. You have the space to talk to your editor about them. So it's very much a collaborative work all the time.
That was Clementine Beauvais there. And she was talking, and you were nodding along, Helen, there. She was talking about how books with feisty girl heroines, don't often land on the laps of boys.
Yes, that's right. And that's one of the things that I'm really, really thrilled with. With Adventure Island is that it wasn't anything sort of absolutely intentional. It was simply that there are two boys and a girl, and for that reason, and that sort of they are absolutely equal, there's no one who is the hero, they do appeal equally to boys and girls. And so often if I go into a school, the boys and the girls are all reading the same books, and I love the fact that they're then talking about the same books together, because I think that's a really important bonding thing, to be able to talk about books together. And unfortunately, often it is the case that at a certain age, the girls will read girls' books and the boys will read boys' books for whatever reason. And it's lovely when, you know, something brings, say, Harry Potter or any of those kind of books that really just appeal across boys and girls. And so I've now sort of got it more in my head that is a real thing that I like to do in my books, for example, in the new series.
And we're drawing to an end now, but do you think post Harry Potter that children's writing is taken more seriously these days?
I think so. It seems to be. I think it really does seem to be. It's a very much, you know, thriving and growing profession, and there's so much room for to be able to do different things within the you know, the broad umbrella of children's books. There's such a range, and as I think Pippa said at the end of her interview, it's a nice job. It is a nice job. It's quite tough sometimes. It's, you know, it's not as easy as I kind of thought it might be, a bit easier and a bit more glamorous when I started. But it is a really, really rewarding and challenging job, and a lovely job to have.
Oh, well, thank you for coming in to talk to us today and sticking through all the technical difficulties that we had. Very much appreciate that. And the next show coming up, hopefully, will be Hitch Free. Our student studio guests will be Gillian McClure, she's an illustrator. We'll also have interviews with Lauren Trimble, who's editor of an online magazine in New York, and poet Kevin Crossley Holland. We're going to play out now, Helen, with your last favourite track, or maybe your first favourite, I don't, High Heel Sneakers, Stevie Wonder. Why did you choose this one?
Well, there's a very good reason for this. It's probably one of the best dance tracks in the world. I think it's almost impossible not to dance when you hear this. As a writer, the major big downside is spending an enormous amount of time sitting on your bottom at a computer and getting very stiff back, rather large bottom. So having to get up and dance every now and then, I think, is something that all writers really appreciate.
The big Stevie Wonder. Everybody, to clap your hands in this group. Come on!